Welcome to Sons of the Flag Radio, brought to you by Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio. It's our mission at Sons of the Flag to revolutionize burn care and the quality of life for veterans, first responders, and families. We want to bring together the passionate community leaders, pioneering physicians, experienced military service members, dedicated first responders, and purposeful civilians to complete our mission. Sons of the Flag believes that the future of burn care resides in research and development. Our vision is to accelerate the process of testing leading technologies and push them into circulation for immediate use by burn survivors across the nation. And I kind of want to start off tonight's show with some really cool information. And by the way, this is Justin Bemis, and I have Landon Shaw, Texas Task Force leader, and then Landon is
digital
like,
director of Sons of the Flag.
Yeah, he does a little bit more than digital directing. Yeah, he's kind of the guru that makes this thing what it is.
I saved the day at the movie screening, so that was nice.
Yeah, Landon's a machine, and so we have Sherry, CEO, president, and then we have Bird, who's obviously still associated with us and does a lot for us, but he's working on other endeavors while helping Sons of the Flag still along the way, and then obviously Greg. And I got a little piece of information I want to throw out there.
Mm-hmm.
Zach, huge news with Zach.
Yeah.
Sutterfield.
Oh, yeah.
Zach graduates college in December.
And Zach is our burn survivor ambassador. He was in an arson fire in 2018. He's come a very long way. He's been in our Mission Reconstruct Freedom program.
He just got back from it again too. Yep. He was stuck in that last hurricane Florida had.
He just got a new ear, and now he can wear glasses. And so he's rocking and rolling, and now he's going to be graduating college.
Yeah, I just wanted to give a shout out to him because you can check out one of our past episodes where we interview Zach, and it's truly an inspirational story of all the issues and the adversity that he was able to overcome. I wanted to start the show off before we get into our fallen heroes that we acknowledge Zach and all of his awesome accomplishments, man. Keep setting the example for the rest of us to be better civilians, to be better just people in life, right?
Absolutely.
Keep doing your thing, homie. We're proud of you here from Sons of the Flag. But like all of our shows, I want to start off tonight's show with a moment of silence for all of our fallen military veterans and first responders and law enforcement, and just take a moment of silence to acknowledge each of them. Logan Taylor, Gary DeCook, Gerardo Rincon, Charles Crampota, Timothy Flager, Michael Moody, Curtis Brown, Brendan Torres, Kenneth Sott, Kevin May, Everett Watson, Alex Moss, Juan Wilson, James Scanlon. And may we also remember all of our fallen law enforcement and military veteran, military personnel that have fallen since our last episode. All right, so tonight's guest, this is a special
one. This is a special one, especially for Veterans Day.
They couldn't come at a better time.
We're recording this on Veterans Day. The episode obviously drops Tuesday, November 22nd, but This is a nice veteran. This is a way to kick off.
It's kind of a
Day.
Cool culmination. So we had Stars and Stripes this week with two World War II vets, Korean and Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Had a whole panel.
And a whole panel up there. And to hear their stories and to be surrounded by their stories and just kind of what they experienced during their time, this is the coolest way, I think, to cap the entire week of celebrating veterans off. And I'm going to start with the story from this gentleman's website.
Okay.
Greg reached out to us and says, I have somebody for the show, and I think you need to take a look at this. And when Greg sends us something...
we perk our ears up.
Usually he's calling to lecture me about not doing something, or I need to get something done, or he's got something really cool to tell us. But I'm going to start with the news article that I've read, and I think it kind of really sets the tone for the story. May 4th, 1970... the retired Air Force captain was one of four crew members and 10 passengers on the flight dubbed Visco 57, leaving Hamilton Air Force Base in Marin County en route to Spokane, Washington, at 8 a.m. on a hazy but otherwise clear morning. And just minutes after takeoff, it clipped a ridge just south of Petaluma, if I'm saying that correct, crashed and caught fire, killing 13 of those on board. Our tonight's guest is the lone survivor from that night, and being the lone survivor comes with a lot of weight, a lot of guilt, and a lot of what ifs. And He's got a lot of questions that are probably going to be left unanswered until we stand at the pearly gates one day. But he was left with severe burns over 65% of his body and multiple internal injuries, and he wasn't expected to live beyond a few weeks. He spent over 3 months in an ICU and then an additional 18 months total in the hospital. And his words perfectly paint this picture of just the horror that was experienced. And he remembers vividly the sound, like it was like when you blow into an air into balloon. He said moments right before the plane actually being cracking up. And so outside the plane window, he saw flames licking over and under the engine. The noise was deafening, he said. The canopy peeled back, and the crew knew they were in dire trouble. Captain George Burke, heard his friend, Master Sergeant Fred Adams, say, "We're not going to make it." And he sat down and buckled the seat. Burke said his last conscious thoughts were whether his insurance policies were up to date. "My kids were 6'4" and 2 years old, and then the impact. He was thrown violently back and forth, breaking his nose and then the fire. Our tonight's guest is U.S. Air Force Captain George Burke. Thank you for joining us, brother.
It's a pleasure, gentlemen. Thank you for inviting me.
So let's talk a little bit about, before we get to the true story, obviously you're an Air Force veteran, you did some time in the service, and you obviously, I think, medically retired in 1971, if I remember correctly, right?
I was medically retired 1 October 71, yes.
What led you to living that life of service? What made you initially want to enlist in the Air Force? Was it a family thing, like a family of origin? Was it something that you were brought up into, or did you just feel the calling to serve?
It was a cultural thing. When I was growing up, military service was an honorable profession. And also my big dream to be able to play professional baseball. From the time I was probably 8 or 9 years old, Little League, Pony League, semi-pro, et cetera, came to an end because late the summer of my after my junior year, playing in a Federation League out of Toledo, Ohio, I hurt my left arm. I was a pitcher, and the scouts they disappeared quickly. My arm never really recovered. I spent the next 6 months or so trying to figure out what in the heck I was going to do with the rest of my life. So one day in Adrian, Michigan, where I was living and went to school, I went down to the Air Force recruiter. My brother-in-law was a captain at the time in the Air Force. He was a pilot. And I signed up to take the Air Force officer's qualifying test. I passed. And within a matter of 60 days, I was on way en route to officer's training school at Lackland Air Force Base, Texas. And I graduated from OTS in May, 1964.
Oh, wow.
Nice. What a quick turnaround.
Yeah, that was a pretty quick turnaround. It's a lot different from how they do it these days. So, the day of the wreck, let's talk about kind of the events leading up to that. Obviously, you knew you were flying to Spokane, Washington that day, right?
Yes.
Did the day just seem like any other ordinary day, or did you have something, a feeling like that premonition, like something just doesn't seem right today? Did you have any of those types of feelings?
That's a good question. And reflection over the years, the weather that morning was unfortunately a precursor to what was going to happen. Of course, none of us knew, but as I found out from the mother of my our three children, I was late leaving the house on base. It took me like 10, 15 minutes to get to the flight line because of the fog and the poor weather. But it was the only time in my military career that I didn't take my – I wasn't wearing my dog tags.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if that was a precursor or whatever, but that's just kind of a small event that that occurred. And I was on my last, what they call TDY, temporary duty. I was on my last trip, next to last trip. I was scheduled. I had a PCS orders to go to Okinawa to assume the duties of the chief controller of the radar approach control facility at Kadena Air Base, which in itself, which back in the day when I was doing that, was essentially a promotion. We all mustered in front of down in base operations at Hamilton, which is now closed. It's the, right outside the main gate was Novato, California, right on Highway 101. And the weather was what they call walks off, visibility in the sky obscured.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, we made our way onto the airplane. It was a Convair T-29, piston-driven, low-wing, two-engine. And there was 13 of us on the plane originally, the manifest. And all of us got on the plane, and my boss, Colonel Eldridge G. Shelton, always wore his orange flying suit, was our co-pilot. And our pilot, Robbie, Daryl Robinson, who's a major, and I found out, again, not too many years ago, that he was retiring and was had already accepted a position in Denver to fly with Evergreen Airlines out of Denver. Mm. He was at the OIC of an AC&W site down in San Jose, California, in one of the mountaintops. Because the weather was so bad and he had to go through San Jose and downtown San Francisco, he was delayed. So Colonel Shelton called the office, and the senior pilot that I knew who was in the office with us, Lieutenant Colonel Ed Morrow, showed up in base operations, and we all got on the airplane. At engine start, Pappy, our crew chief, brought the stairs up, pressure locks, etc., felt all the sensation with the pressure change, and we began to taxi away from front of base operations. And historically, I always sat in the front compartment, aisle seat, flying backwards. Excuse me. And Freddie Adams and Kenny Yarger, two of the senior NCOs at E7 and E8, respectively, were seated in the front compartment next to me. They were both next to windows.
Mm-hmm.
And 8 or 9 of the other guys, all Air Force, were in the back compartment. As we began to taxi away from base ops, we taxied probably 30 or 40 yards, and I heard the brake squeal, and we rocked to a stop. And I remember Freddie yelling, talking to me, to the both of us, what's going on? I said, well, maybe Robbie showed up. Well, I unbuckled my seatbelt, raised my arms on the armrest, peered into the cockpit through the structural bulkhead doorway. The nav was in his table. F.D. Harrod was in his nav table, going along for the 4 hours to get his flight time. Our crew chief, Pappy, deployed the stairs and did the pressure locks. Enrique Ferrer was a staff sergeant. He was our flight engineer, pushed away from the flight engineer position. Ed Moore undid his harnesses and stepped off the airplane. Robbie got on. The door come up, pressure locks, seatbelts locked. Engine number two engine started, began to taxi away from front of base ops. I leaned across the aisle where there were bench seating, and there were three windows, and I saw Ed Morrow, Colonel Morrow, in his flight suit disappear through the door into base operations. Hmm. We taxied down and into the runway. We're on a special hold from San Francisco Center because of the weather. Finally, we had a pocket of air open up, and we got what to call a special IFR departure, and began to roll down the runway, roar the engines, etc., climbing out, making a climbing right-hand turn. As it turned out, I thought it was just a minute or two, but it was 9 minutes into the flight.
Oh, wow.
When they had removed my GI-issue sunglasses over the roar of the engines, I hollered to Freddie and Kenny. I wanted to talk about the trip. We were going back for the second time on an air traffic control analysis of Fairchild Air Force Base. But I wanted to take a nap, and I crossed my arms and laid my head on my arms. And the next thing I remember hearing was a crackling sound, and right off Kenny Yarger's left shoulder, the window glazing cracked. Don't know if it was the inside or outside, but halfway up, and I yelled, roared over the roar of the engines, Kenny, you better go forward and tell Pappy we may have a problem. Well, he unbuckled and wore his blue Air Force raincoat, went forward, and it wasn't more than just a few seconds. Then I heard a only louder, more pronounced than a slight pause, and the airplane decompressed.
Oh, wow.
The windows were blown out. It pitched violently nose down.
What was y'all's elevation at the time? Sorry.
I'm sorry?
What was y'all's elevation at this time?
Well, I found out we were 2,900 feet.
Okay.
9 minutes into the flight, 2,900 feet, we had rapid decompression. After, when the airplane was pitching on and rolling, I unbuckled my seatbelt, stood up, did a 180-degree turn, and grabbed a hold of the structure bulkhead doorway with my two hands. And the wind shear was so great that Kenny's blue Air Force raincoat was from his armpits out, was like a flag. Hmm. It was flapping in the breeze, and I glanced quickly into the cockpit. I saw Pappy had the door handle down to keep it from severing at the fuselage. I saw a strip of white light. Colonel Shelton, half the steering, half of the steering wheel, the column, was back and forth, left to right. The instrumentation panel was back on his lap. Top part of the canopy was peeled back. The left side of the cockpit was completely gone. And although I do not consciously remember seeing him decapitated, but I told people around me for the next, I'm still somewhat alert, that Robbie had his head, he was decapitated, his shoulders. I sat back down on my seat, buckled my seatbelt, and put something in my lap, a cushion or a blanket that had blown free, assumed a survival position, and knew I was dead. And my last conscious thought was, I hope my insurance policies are intact. Then I remember the impact, hitting the ground, breaking and shearing and bending a metal. I was thrust violently back against the structural bulkhead. And like a rag doll from my waist forward, I was thrust violently forward and hit the table in front of me. And it broke my nose, as it turned out. But I had no sensation of blood. When the airplane stopped moving, I unbuckled my seatbelt. And right around that time, when we were going down, I remember Freddie yelling, "We're not going to, my God, we're not going to make it." After we impacted, the airplane stopped moving. I unbuckled my seatbelt a second time, stood three-quarter standing position towards the aisle. And then the next thing I remember was a flashover, a great deal of heat, which was the flashover from the fire in the airplane.
Oh,
then everything went black. Then I opened my eyes right outside the airplane, face down, didn't know what had happened, didn't know where I was, thought I was having a very bad dream. I laid there for just a few seconds, and all that, at this time, time is irrelevant. And I rolled over, my hands were black, my left hand especially was really badly charred, and the skin was hanging off my left hand like softball-sized globs of skin. I remember looking at my low quarters, my leather low quarters. My laces in my right shoe were tied. The laces in my left shoe were gone, and I thought that was rather unusual. And I rolled back over in my stomach and my elbows, because I remember to this day still recall hearing what I heard were yells and screams inside the airplane. And I was perpendicular to the aircraft, which was still involved. And 180-degree crawling on my elbows and my knees back to just a few feet from the airplane, I heard a hissing noise, a muffled explosion, a great deal of heat in my face. And I remember thinking to myself, and I'll abbreviate it, but there's nobody alive in that SOB. I better get back where I came from.
Yeah.
So I reversed course 180 degrees on elbows and knees, crawling over what turned out to be parts of airplane, the eucalyptus trees. I saw Pappy off to my left about 10 yards away, and he was badly burned and puncture wound. And I glanced at the 2 o'clock position, probably 20 yards away from me up on the ridge. I saw one of my good friends, Major Bob Ward. He was badly burned, and smoke was coming off his body. And the voice inside my head, get on your feet, keep your body functions moving. If you're laying, you're going to die. I don't want to die. So I started to get up, forced myself on my feet. I felt a terrible pain in the lower part of my back. And I thought to myself, my God, my back's broken. And I said, the other voice was saying, you dumb shit, if your back was broken, you wouldn't be able to walk. So I turned again when I was upright, and I waved my arms over my head, and I hollered, hey, anybody alive? The top third had burned through. I heard snap, crackle, and pop. I was told many, many months later, we had 1,500 gallons of avgas on board, 1,500 pounds of avgas, and they estimated the fire was like 1,800 degrees. God. So I saw three small trees down the pasture. Again, I didn't know where I was. Mm-hmm. It was foggy and it was misting, low clouds, rolling pasture land, or rolling land. And I thought to myself, if I could get inside this, position myself in this way, in between, in the middle of this waist-high prairie grass, and help me keep warm, because I was going into shock.
Right.
And I was getting colder. I sensed I was dying. I knew I was dying. I felt my life leaving me. And I was telling myself, walk, breathe. Take another step. I found myself about 40 yards. I managed to stumble 40 yards from the crash site. I lowered myself gingerly in the middle of this waist-high prairie grass. I pulled myself up in a prenatal position. I began to pray. Please God, don't let me die in this field all alone. No time to say goodbye to anybody. This is a bad dream. Someone's playing a joke on me. Any moment I'm going to wake up.
Right.
I ran my good right hand through my hair, and I saw white ash appear across my face. And from my neck up was the sensation I was being stung by millions of bees.
Oh.
And I laid there for what turned out to be about 40 minutes, and I was shaking so violently that the moist prairie grass was shaking. All the while, praying, no time to say goodbye to my kids, their mother, excuse me, my family. And I, like a holograph, I saw pictures of my life, from Little League to Pony League to the schoolyard, the things that had happened in my life, going across my mind, my brain, the quote-unquote mind's eye,
right,
which was my mind attempting to me to maintain some level of in touch with reality.
Yeah.
Because I was dying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I knew I was dying. I sensed that life was leaving my body. Well, it turned out, as I said, about 40 minutes. I laid there about 40 minutes. Then I heard voices from below me coming up this hill, this pasture. I forced myself on my feet a second time, waved my arms again, hollered, hey, over here. Fell back down in a heap. Next two guys that the people showed up were two men that turned out they were volunteers, firefighter volunteers from the Shellville VFD, who years later I met, and they didn't know who I was.
Wow.
Really emotional. And I looked up through this grass, was vibrating, remembering what my face felt like. And I said, what about my face? And the one man, his name turned out to be Richard St. Laurent, said, leaned back in his knees, said, oh, my God. And I thought to myself, holy shit, you must look like hell.
Oh, man.
So one of the lessons that I passed on to all the many firefighters that I've been privileged to speak to over the years, is even when you don't think someone can hear you, they can hear you.
Yeah.
Never say anything negative around a survivor, a victim.
Yep.
Celebrate, quote unquote, when you get back to the firehouse. Don't do it at the site.
Yeah.
Even when you're putting someone in an ambulance or the rescue truck or wherever it might be, talk positive. You don't think they're responding to you. They may not, but they can hear you. They may not be there where you are. Their mind's taking them away to try to minimize what they are feeling, what they sense, what they know is going to happen. They're trying to process all this stuff in their brain. There's a great disbelief of what just happened. Talk positively to them, or don't say anything at all. Tell them what you're going to do and where you're going. Don't say anything negative, because it's just simply magnified.
Yeah.
Then I heard helicopter. They scrambled a Coast Guard helicopter from San Francisco International. They finally found a crash site from the help of Mrs. Davio, the rancher that found me accidentally on fire, who I didn't know that anybody found me at the time. They put me in a gurney, slid me into the side of the Coast Guard helicopter. It was a Jolly Green, the pararescue who I worked real close with at Da Nang. 18 months, this accident happened 18 months after I come back from Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
When I was at Da Nang, I worked real close with those guys as an air traffic control officer at Da Nang. And the staff sergeant was wearing his fatigues and his red beret. And he said, "Hi, Captain Burke." I said, "Do you know Master Sergeant Johnson?" He said, "Yes, sir, I do." I said, "Would you tell him that I said to say hello?" And that's when I hear crack, crack, my first introduction to morphine. Everything goes zero, blank. I open my eyes. I'm on a gurney in the emergency room at Hamilton. They take me down in an elevator, lift me onto a cold, hard tray table. It hurt like hell, but as my doctors at the burn unit told me many months later, they were concerned about my multiple internal fractures.
Yeah,
they weren't concerned about my burns, but one thing I didn't need was more radioactivity.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't need to be radiated again because I was burned severely and the skin was gone. And that's when they found all the fractures in my spine, my vertebrae, etc., shoulders, neck, back, etc. So they put me back on a gurney, took me up to the hospital, upstairs. My immediate supervisor, Lieutenant Colonel Johnson, was there. My mother and my three children was there at the time. And I remember they were about ready to take me down to the flight line. I looked over my left shoulder and I mouthed to my ex-wife, my mother, and my three children, "I'm sorry." They, in the back of an Air Force ambulance, down to the flight line, while I was riding in that thing, I always thought to myself, always wanted to ride in one of these things, but never back here.
Yeah.
I was on the flight line in the ambulance, and I heard I remember thinking, that sounds like a C-141. Smells like JP-4. Not long after that, four guys in white scrubs showed up, pulled me out of the back of the Air Force ambulance, carried me across the tarmac, up in the back of the C-141. The door, they strapped me into the right side of the fuselage, about halfway back. The ramp came up, the lights came on. The morphine started to wear off. I'm starting to get insane with thirst. I had no spit. Still trying to process what happened. Bad dream, gonna wake up. Please God, don't let me die. Then my peripheral vision was still pretty good. And a real pretty blonde flight nurse appeared off to my right. And the arrogance and the ego of the male, I thought she was coming over to talk to me. And she said, "Open your mouth." I did. "Stick out your tongue." I did. And gave me a nice chip. I realized now it was for body fluids, because when you're burned,
yep,
your body fluids are gone. You have no, there's nothing to retain it. The largest organ we have in our body is our skin. So when I took the ice chip, I remember thinking, like a governor on a car, there's a governor on your brain.
Mm-hmm.
When I was burned and I was the way I was feeling mentally, physically, and emotionally, the governor was gone. There's no barrier. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm laying here dying. I'm dying of thirst. And she gives me a blanking ice chip, but I didn't say blanking. Then everything goes black. Then I hear squeal, squeal, turn, turn, ramp, hot air, whap, whap. Nothing. Elevator, elevator fan, a gurney, a cart, people around me dressed in white, wearing masks. Where am I? Who are these people? I was at the burn unit at Pork Army Medical Center in San Antonio. Out of the elevator, a set of doors, boom, double set of doors, boom, into a room, people on me like white on rice, talking to me, who are you, what's your name, when you're born, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to wash you off with FISOX. This is going to burn. And I remember yelling, no shit. Lieutenant Colonel, Army nurse, asked me, are you allergic to anything? And I thought, well, I'm in a dream. I know I'm going to come out of this. I'm going to try to be funny. And I said, yeah, fire. And it was one of those pauses where the world, everything in that room stopped for like 5 seconds.
Oh.
And they told me later, again, weeks, months and months later, they thought that was pretty funny. So, and I realized I wasn't dreaming. And they took me to the ICU and hooked me up and put me in a special bed. I was 6'5" and a half, and I weighed about 215 pounds at the time, new edema and body fluid and I'm going to swell and all that stuff. And I hooked me up to a ventilator and tubes and catheter and my nose and my mouth. And I was fairly alert for the first 10 days. And then that's when I started to, that's when I really started getting sick. And that's when all the infections and the viruses, as often back then and still do now, but obviously fortunately technology, like anything else, is burn care has changed dramatically. Yeah. Thank God.
Yeah.
Everything learns from everything else. It's built upon successes and failures.
Yep.
And,
I wanted to ask you, so we've interviewed multiple burn survivors, and there's a kind of a theme or continuous theme. Whenever they get burned and they get into treatment, they almost lose their memory. Like they forget this period of time. How much of your treatment do you remember? Do you remember from the jump getting, you know, to the whole 18 months? I know Zach, he didn't remember 6 months of his treatment. He just, his brain just blocked it out. Were you very cognizant of the whole treatment and everything going on?
After I spent 89 days in the ICU in the first 10 days of what I remember, my mind took me away from where I was to places that I had been, to people that I knew. It was like a dream. It's like you're in bed having a dream. Only the dreams where I was cold, bitterly cold, had difficulty breathing, and I saw people that were in my life in places where they shouldn't be in my life, like in a field hospital.
Yeah.
There was Colonel Shelton wearing a white coat with a stethoscope around his neck. I'm thinking, what's Colonel Shelton doing here? He's dead. And there were events similar to that. I remember dreaming My mind was trying to minimize as much as possible the pain and the cold that I was experiencing at the time. And then there were other times I don't remember anything. The people around me, I do remember one time someone saying, probably right after I got into the burn unit and before the mother of my three children and my mother arrived early the next morning of May the 5th, that someone somewhere said, it looks like a white man trapped inside black skin.
Oh, man.
And I thought, oh, you know, all the curse words start coming out.
Yeah.
But I don't remember. I don't remember much of that other than people around me were poking me and talking to me. And I don't know how detailed you want me to get, but there are parts of the male brain that even when you're dying and you're sick still work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because two of my younger ICU nurses who were Army captains, who I, again, found out later, they had come back from Vietnam to the burn unit, would come in, and I would hear, like, my ex-wife would come in. I would hear them talk, females, and I had a catheter. I remember one time looking down a special bed and looking down between my legs and had a little white cloth over my genital area. And when I would hear a female's voice, I would get aroused.
Oh, no.
That's a true story. The nurses would come in and they would play with me. They knew what they saw what was happening and they would tease me.
Oh my God.
To get me to mentally to get that part of the brain. They knew I was alive. They did whatever they had to do to keep me active, to keep me thinking. And they would tease me. And they would say, "Hey Captain, I see you're making some pop tents." And I remember that. And part of my brain was laughing. And I was thinking to myself something, yeah, you're right. I can still make a pop thing. Well, they knew that part of the brain was still working. And they worked that. They just didn't ignore it.
Interesting.
And there were other examples like that. I was in, I found myself all of a sudden awake. My eyes opened. And my mind found a very special place. I wasn't cold.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to breathe, but I was on a ventilator.
Mm-hmm.
I was comfortable. I didn't want to even move, even think I was moving. And the nurse turned out to be a civilian. Her name was Mrs. Wolf with an E.
Uh-huh.
Gown, bonnet, mask, gloves. She was around my bed, tucking in my bed in the ICU, saying, "George this, George this, George that," talking to me, stimulating. Mm-hmm. And I do vaguely remember telling her, "I'm a captain in the United States Air Force, and don't you forget it." So well, I found out later, much later, that she had a choice. She made a decision. She could have laughed and let it alone, but she left the ICU and right across outside the door, across, you know, 3-4 feet across the aisle, 5 feet across the aisle, was the nurse's station. And behind the nurse's station were the docs made their transcriptions.
Mm-hmm.
And she went back in behind the nurse's station to find my primary care physician, Welford W. Inns Jr., who I've been able to bless to see many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
He just passed away this last January in Dover, Delaware. She told him what just transpired, and he said he wrote it up and told them all, write it up in the medical records, which he did. And from now on, you call him Captain Burke.
That's awesome.
And the remaining time I was in that burn unit, people walked up to me when I come out of the ICU in the hallway, and they would say, "Hey, Captain Burke, how are you doing?" I said, "Who the hell are you?" I just saw Dr. Inge. I climbed on an airplane here in Phoenix and flew to Dover. I'm Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. He drove an hour and a half north from Dover, Delaware. He'd been retired, and I hadn't seen him in 35 years. He met me at curbside, and I start crying.
Yeah.
Yeah, understandably.
I said, you son of a bitch. I know who you are. I'd pick you up out of a lineup.
Yeah.
he started laughing, and he got emotional. We hugged and talked on the way down. I walked into his house. Mrs. Inge was in the kitchen. I walked over and offered my hand. I said, hello, Mrs. Inge. I'm Captain Burke. She started crying. She said, wow. Oh, I know who you are.
Wow.
We had a wonderful 3.5-day weekend. And we were in his living room, in the living room talking. And we were sharing stories. He said, you remember the time when you came around, they were toe-tagging people. It's basically what they were doing. Mm-hmm. We came to your bed, and someone said, he's not going to make it. And he said, you were comatose. We couldn't get you to respond. Someone said, he's not going to make it. And he said, you know what you did? I said, no, sir, I don't. He said, you opened your eyes and you screamed, like hell, I'm not going to make it. I don't want to die. I want to live.
Oh, wow.
They said, I don't remember the tankings. Thank God.
Yeah.
A black corpsman that I had used to stick the bird down my throat, in my mouth, or make me blow back mm-hmm. 15 times. Not 13. Not 16. 15. And I hated him. I hated them all, but I loved him.
Yeah.
Every time I saw him come into the IC, he was the only black corpsman we had. He had big hands. He stuck that tube down my throat and said, hey, coach me. It's in my, I have it in one of my two books.
Oh, wow.
Come on, Captain Burke. That's 15. Come on. My toes would feel like they were curling.
Mm-hmm,
I was screaming inside my body. I was begging him to leave me alone. Come on, Cap. That's 12. Come on, Captain. That's 11. Come on, Captain. That's 10. Come on, Captain. That's 9. Two or three times a day. Then the nurse would come in, stick a tube down into my lungs, through my throat, in my nose, down in my lungs, and suction all the infection out.
Yeah.
Went up into my family, told me up in the black bottle. A bottle that was bubbling with infection up behind me.
Mm.
11, 12, longer than that. It was 7 months, 8 months later, I'm down in a step-down facility. I'm still sick, legs wrapped, can hardly walk. I'm shuffling down the hallway one day with a snow cone on what's left of my left hand. My fingers are gone. I've got a cleft. My fingers are burned down to the bone.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this big black corpsman coming down the hallway in his scrubs. And I look at him, and he looks at me, and his eyes start to water. And I'm in blue pajamas. Legs wrapped from my ankle to my groin, wrapped around my back, a snow cone. And I look at him, and he looks at me, and I said, are you that big black son of a bitch who used to stick that tube down my throat and maybe blow back 15 times? He looked at me and said, yes, sir, that's me. I reached up with my right arm as best I could because I just had right elbow surgery. Mm-hmm. Put my arm around his neck, and I started to cry. And he started to cry. I said, thank you for saving my life. Hmm. He said, it's okay, Captain. I was just doing my job.
You're going through this treatment. You were in treatment for 18 months, correct?
Yes, I was.
So after you get out of treatment, how do you return to a state of normalcy? What is the path forward for you from there? Because I know that you got your bachelor's, you got your master's, you've taught at universities. What was it like getting back on that path to saying, this is not going to define my life. I'm going to find a way around this, and this I'm going to conquer this, and I'm going to make this a strength.
There's a lot of different, there's different ways that I can answer that. It all depends on the socioeconomic norms of the person,
mm-hmm.
Literally how they were raised, where they were raised, the parental involvement, the love in the home, the self-respect, the strength they have as a human being, their competitive nature through athletics, etc. It's a worn-out cliche, but it's true. Life is all about choices.
Yeah.
And early on, I made a choice that I was not going to act nor expect anyone to interact with me and deal with me like I'm a victim.
Mm-hmm.
I demanded of myself through time, through choices, you come to different forks in the road, as Yogi Berra said, you take it.
Mm-hmm.
You got to make choice the right one. Sometimes you can back up and go to the other fork. Sometimes you can't and right. learn to deal with the consequences, et cetera.
Yeah.
But I learned early on, I told myself early on that I am a survivor.
Mm-hmm.
Spiritually, physically, emotionally, I am not a victim.
Mm-hmm.
I am not going to live my life as a victim. I'm going to have issues. I know I will. I still do to this day, and I'm 81 years old. I'm dealing with them
mm-hmm.
physically,
yeah,
physiologically. I don't want, you know, there's many, one of the things I share with my audiences, especially my younger audiences, the difference between a winner and a whiner is two letters.
Yep.
Yeah.
How do you spell?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right on the money on that, because I think just in society yeah, itself,
yeah,
a victim and a survivor, I mean, so many people, it's not an interchangeable term for most people that encounter some sort of traumatic issue. And you got to have the right resources in place. Like you said, it might be your family. It might be some sort of mental health coach or some outside sources that are going to help you. But serving that mindset from being a victim to an actual survivor is huge,
yeah.
especially in the recovery process. You know, whether it be a rape victim or whatever it may be, you're not a victim, you're a survivor. And
yeah.
you use your message just like you are, Captain Burt, use that message and push that message out to society and say, listen, it stops now.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're a survivor.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
have the opportunity to influence, change, and affect people in a very positive way, especially those that are in the darkest spots, burn survivors.
Yeah.
It's not just a burn survivor. You can probably attest that it's not just you that suffered. It was your three kids. It was your ex-wife at the time, the mother of your three kids. It was your family. Everybody's in this. Everybody's a survivor together.
I've seen a number of guys when I was in the burn unit. Of course, a lot of the guys that I was there were burned in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, you got what you deserve.
Yeah.
There were guys that came home from Vietnam that burned the uniforms at the aerial port. There was guys that came home from Vietnam, didn't tell their family they had been in Vietnam.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you're burned and you're burned on active duty, it's one paradigm.
Yeah.
But when you're burned in combat, especially a place like Vietnam, when the country was split pretty much 50-50.
Right.
And you're evac back and you're living and you're burned and you're scarred and you may not have a face. Hmm. You may not have a limb or two. You may be blind. You may be disfigured to some degree or another. And people look at you, your family, family members reject you.
Mm-hmm.
I could tell you, there was a guy that laid next to me. He was an Army aviator. His family used to come home when I was out in the ward. This is after I got out of the ICU, but I was still sick. Rotating beds and spit pans and all that stuff. Still being tanked. And his family would come in to the edge. He was within 2 feet of me in the bed on the right side. I remember opening my eyes one morning and smelled something that was different than a burn unit with the sulfadine and the flesh and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out he had gangrene in his one arm. They amputated his arm. And his family would come over and visit him. And they would stand at the foot of his bed and cry. I remember eventually over time, I'd see a family, my bed was back, rotated up, and I looked down into the hallway as it entered into the main ward. And there'd be the mother would come in, and then the father would come in, one or two at a time. And fast forward 7 months. And I sooner than that. I remember opening my eyes one day and the bed was gone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was gone.
Oh, wow.
And I talked to one of the nurses, the corpsman. I said, I see the guy next to me. He died. Oh. And one of my corpsmen told me, no, Captain, he didn't die. He gave up.
Oh, no.
He didn't have he had nothing to live for.
Yeah.
He had no encouragement from the outside. Family is extremely important, spiritually, yeah, emotionally, physiologically. If you give a man a why to live, he can endure almost any how.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
People on the outside have to plant that seed sometimes or replant it as to the why to continue doing what you have to do, going through the physical pain, going through the psychological pain, or the questions that you have about yourself, your manhood, your womanhood, and just deal with the process as it comes along. And you have to learn how to eat right, think right, get into a climate that's as best suited for the type of injury that you have. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm back in Arizona. There's a dry heat.
Yeah.
Yep.
And another thing I learned from people around me, people took care of me. They gave me a job. They stood behind me outside my family, which also was very, very important. Mm-hmm. They gave me a reason to continue. I had a job. I had a desk to go to when I left the burn unit. But another thing I learned, you have to surround yourself with people that want you to succeed, not fail.
You got to build your team.
Yep.
And you learn, you have to learn to change the internal script, the words you use. And you find negativity creeping into the mind, you say, get out, get rid of it. You change the paradigm. You change the thought. You change the environment. It comes down to literally sometimes, if you have family members or friends that treat you differently, you have a choice. Continue to expose yourself to that, or you eliminate the source of the discomfort.
Yep.
So did you... Obviously, you're 81 now. Battling, I hate calling it PTSD. It's not a disorder in my mind because I suffer from, you know, I suffer. I know a lot of great individuals who suffer from post-traumatic stress. You know, a disorder means it controls you and it debilitates you and it does every little aspect in your life. And I don't like to consider it a disorder. But how did you, obviously going through such a traumatic experience, 18 months in the hospital, your entire world has, and your entire dynamic and your livelihood has been flipped upside down. How did you deal with the PT, you know, the post-traumatic stress even to today? How do you cope with it? And what kind of information can you pass along to some of our listeners who are either a burn survivors or go through traumatic events? How can they instill some sort of thought process in their life or do take some sort of actions to begin the healing process? We're never going to be healed fully, but we can begin the process to build, like you said, build that team and build the resources we need in the right place. What can you offer to some of our listeners?
Well, I guess the best way to start to answer that question is one time I met with Dr. Inge, legs wrapped, snow cone, tree with tubes going into my chest. Now, again, I was down step down facility to get exercise. And Corman helped me out of the bed, put my slippers on, and I shuffled down the hallway, going on the elevator, went up to the third floor, and walked through the doors and saw Dr. Inge. And he had time, and he came in a nurse's break station with a coffee urn, and I got pillows. I had no butt. I was about 130 pounds, and I was sitting on pillows with my legs propped up on a chair with pillows. He was in his scrubs. His mask was around his neck. Gloves were off, and I was talking to him. I was venting.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out why, how, what am I supposed to do? I shared in detail, in color, my two near-death experiences with Colonel Shelton on the boat, on the bridge, the light, the smell of flowers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm too young to die. I got to break free of his grasp and go back where I came from. I was shut from my feet, back to the deck of the boat, stepped down, very difficult. I saw him in his orange, the waist above his waist in his orange flying suit, with all these other people running, had run past us through this white, through this, into this white light. And all of a sudden, I'm looking down a long tunnel, reverse one lens of a binocular, the brightest light I've ever seen. Again, I do see two figures, loud rushing of wind. And there's Freddie Adams and Kenny Yarger in uniforms. And I said, "Freddie, Kenny, what the hell are you guys doing here?" And Freddie always kind of talked out of the side of his mouth. He said, "It's okay, Captain Burke. We're all right. You need to get better." Whoosh.
Wow.
Back down the tunnel. And I shared with this in vivid detail the emotion and how I got onto the boat. And 15 minutes later, Colonel Sheldon comes over and lifts me out from underneath behind his table. And there's people on either side of me. I couldn't hear anything. Miles were moving. I'm getting sicker and colder and sicker and colder, shuffling my feet. And he looked at me, looked at the ceiling, and he looked back at me, straightened my eyes. He said, "Now I know what you're trying to tell us." I said, "What the hell are you talking about, Doc?" And he told me the date and time, ICU, probably late July, I think, that banks of lights around you to try to keep you warm, homografts, pigskins, sulfadine, sulfamylon, you're bitterly cold, shaking. I used to shake so much, my nurses told me, my family, that I used to shake the pigskin and homografts off me.
Oh, gosh.
The trauma.
Gosh.
He said, "One time with the lights around your bed, you open your eyes and you were screaming, 'The light, the light, the light, the light, the light.'"
Wow.
And I think my mother or my wife, my ex-wife was there. Dr. Inge was there. And some of them saying, "What light, George? What light?" I kept screaming, "The light, the light, the light, the light, the light, the what light, what light, the light, the light." Finally, they couldn't. They thought it was the lights around my bed. They moved the bed, thinking it was blinding me. They gave me more morphine and sedated me. 6 months later, I'm in this chair talking to him. And then I realized what I experienced was real.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I had two near-death experiences.
Yeah.
And then I asked him, "What am I supposed to do with the rest of my life, Doc? Mm-hmm. Why me?" He paused and said, "George, you've experienced what we call the will to survive. And you have to find a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
You have to find a reason for you to continue to live your life. You have to find a purpose in your life. No one can find it for you. You have to find it yourself." I thought to myself, whoa. And then I asked him, "Doc, what happens to the guys when they leave here? Because the 89 days I was in the ICU, my family saw 19 people pass away. Most of them young kids, veterans, Marines primarily, and crew and airmen." When I asked him that question, he paused and said, "George, we don't know. We heal the body. We don't have time to heal the mind."
Yeah.
And little did I know how how prophetic that was.
Yeah.
How meaningful that was. I never went to counseling. The counseling wasn't available.
Mm-hmm.
The VA was a joke.
Well,
in some respects, I think it still is.
I don't think much has changed from my
post-traumatic post to me. And I talked to a lot of psychologists, Navy PhDs that have camps where I spoke for 5 or 6 years up in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And others have told me, some people may not like this, but PTSD mm-hmm. was created by people to sell drugs, get the veterans on the good stuff. They don't get the Acme pill.
Yeah.
They don't get the generic pill. They get the good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
At one camp I was in Maryland, I met a young trooper, Afghan veteran, was on 14 different meds.
Jesus.
I kind of casually said, "Hey, Doc," to a female. She's a Navy commander, PhD. I said, "Do you think maybe this is all, it's post-traumatic stress disorder. It's mental instead of emotional to keep people on drugs." She looked at me. She said, "You think?"
Yeah.
Ugh.
It's you're right. It's post-traumatic stress.
Mm-hmm.
It's emotional.
Yeah.
It's not mental.
Correct.
And it's spiritual.
And I have met a couple of survivors and civilian survivors at down here in Phoenix. It's been a number of years where I asked a guy, he was in his coveralls, and I met him at a burn camp up in Prescott. This is, it's 1999. And he was a counselor, and he was burned. He told me he walked into his house and smelled gas and lit a match. Well, you know what happened.
Yeah.
And he was burned, spent some time in a Maricopa County burn unit, et cetera. And he's up walking around, and there's some burns on his hands and his body, whatever. And I met him at the camp up here, and I said, his counselor, and we sat down, and we were talking. I said, what do you do? He said, I do this. I said, what do you mean you do this? I said, what else do you do? He said, oh, I don't do anything else. I come up to the camp once a year, and that's all I do. And I went, wow.
Huh.
So, you know, counseling can become a crutch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Counselors have to tell the people what they need to know, not what they want to hear.
Yeah.
You have to help them find a roadmap.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have to give them the tools, yep, emotionally, spiritually.
Yeah.
Goes about the empowerment.
To work that roadmap. But eventually, it's the person, the survivors, to make the decision to go from acting and thinking and being portrayed as a victim to a survivor. Mm-hmm. And that's a journey. That's a process. They have to get on that roadmap, and they have to walk that roadmap and work that roadmap themselves. No one can find a purpose for them. They have to find it themselves.
Yeah, that seems to be something that we hear from all the burn survivors and all the veterans that we speak mm-hmm. to. You know, they go through something traumatic, and then it's they have that first process of just coping or coming to terms with it, and then after you come to terms with it, you're like, okay, well, what do I do after this? And it's extremely inspirational and amazing to work around these individuals who have been through that and have come out on the other side and have taken control of their lives and have taken charge.
Now they're ambassadors.
And now they're ambassadors.
Yes, they're ambassadors.
And they can tell their stories, and they can help others understand that you're not stuck here. This is just a position that you're in right now, but you are not stuck here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what you have? Another thing, one of the other things, one of not lessons that I've learned per se, but observations that I've made, is that when a burn victim works towards survivorship, mm-hmm. their care team, i.e. their family, a wife or a husband, sometimes they are required to leave their job temporarily or quit their job, and their mission, their purpose, is to help their son, their veteran son, their daughter, their child, overcome, make those first steps,
mm-hmm.
to get them towards the second part of their life, their journey. And then when that time comes, positively speaking, when that veteran, son or daughter, when that child, when that husband, when that wife gets to the point where they don't need the caregiver,
mm-hmm.
the caregiver looks around and says, what do I do now?
Yeah.
What am I supposed to do? What's my purpose? And a lot of times, I equate it to going through a tunnel. Sometimes the tunnel, oftentimes the tunnel is dark, it's cold, it's menacing, it's fearful, filled with anxiety and depression and doubt,
mm-hmm.
self-doubt. You kind of push yourself through that tunnel, crawl, step, whatever choice you make to decide to go through that tunnel. Sometimes the tunnel is short. Sometimes the tunnel is very long.
Mm-hmm.
But when you go through that, when you come out, you make a choice, and God blesses you and gives you life, and people around you give you your life back, and they work their asses off to keep you alive and give you every opportunity to live. And that comes to fruition. and you come out of that tunnel, wherever, whenever that happens, while you're in the hospital, after you leave the hospital, the light at the other end of the tunnel becomes brighter and brighter and brighter. The sun shines brighter. The sky is bluer. The birds chirp louder. A dog's lick is better.
Yep.
The grass smells greener. Yep. The air smells fresher after a rain. The snow crunches louder under your feet.
Well,
and then you, oftentimes you leave people behind.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's just part of moving forward. And one of the things that I've gathered. So I'm the civilian of the group, speaking with veterans and first responders. And one of the things that I continuously gather from these conversations is, you know, I take information for myself and utilize it, you know, with in my daily life. Like, you don't have to have gone through a traumatic episode to take these lessons that people who have been through these traumatic episodes and implement them in your everyday life and really forge a course forward with that same mentality and that same concept of I'm not stuck here. I can make it through here. And learning right. from individuals like yourself and the other people that we've been fortunate enough to interview has been it's been a serious honor. And we're coming to the end of our interview, but I just want to say from the bottom of my heart, reading your story and seeing your interviews, it's been an incredible journey for me since Greg shared your name with us. It's been an incredible journey for me to see, to study you and to finally get to talk to you.
Thank you. If I may, could I leave my website?
Yeah, I wanted to plug your stuff real quick, if you don't mind. GeorgeBurk.com, correct?
That's correct.
GEORK.com. Yeah, Burke.
It's inactive because I no longer travel and I no longer speak, but that my website tells a story.
And yes, it does.
You've also written a book, correct?
Four.
I've written four books.
Four books.
Two of them deal with the accident rescue recovery. The first one is The Bridge Never Crossed,
mm-hmm.
A Survivor's Search for Meaning. The second one is Laugh You Live, Cry You Die, A Burn Survivor's Triumph Over Tragedy.
Nice.
And if anybody wanted to reach out to you, is there a way for them to be able to contact you, an email if they had a question, or if they wanted to reach out, just have a conversation with you, just from something
Absolutely.
That they heard, how would they be able to get a hold of you?
Absolutely. They can email me, G Burke, GBURK. At GeorgeBurk.com, GBURK at GeorgeBurk.com. My cell phone is 480-212-6321, 480-212-6321. Call or text. Anybody would like to reach out? You play it forward, brother.
Yeah.
Life is about playing it forward.
Absolutely. Well, from the bottom of my heart, man, I just thank you for sharing your story. Landon and I have just been sitting here in awe.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we have these interviews, and sometimes we find it difficult to where we can interject and stuff like that because the story is so impactful, and it for me and Bemis, every detail that you're discussing matters, and you know, we kind of get stuck in this just like in the zone listening to the incredible stories and the incredible journeys of individuals like yourself. And we're extremely thankful for that.
Absolutely.
Well, bless you boys.
Brother, thank
bless
you.
Bless you boys for what you're doing. God bless you. You're making a difference. Believe me.
Absolutely.
You're making a difference.
And we're not, and we're nowhere near stopping and we're going to keep on trucking.
Good. Pass the salt and make a difference.
Absolutely.
Pass the salt, make a difference. Leave a person, place, a thing a little better for you having been there.
Absolutely, brother.
I like that a lot. Well, right. Sir, thank you for talking to us, and we look forward to hopefully speaking to you in the future.
I welcome that opportunity, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be on your show.
I appreciate
thank
it,
you,
Cap.
Sir. Bye.
Take care. God bless you. Bye-bye.
God bless. Man, that...
You know,
a story like that, I mean, you kind of just hang on every word.
What I like is 10-year anniversary for Sons of the Flag.
Yeah.
and it really puts into perspective what Byrd's goal was, right? He talked about burn care during the Vietnam era, and that's what Byrd always kind of alluded to, that we've never really progressed. We have.
Now we have.
But
when he started.
Correct. And we weren't making the strides that we need to, and to listen to the story and just to understand, just to put yourself in the place of where he was at for those 18 months. And just like everybody else that deals with burns, it's not just 18 months. It's now a lifetime.
Yeah. Yeah.
Look at Zach. Zach's going to be, it's a lifetime of burn care. And Shay. Yeah.
I mean, Shay was burned as a kid.
Yes, absolutely.
And he's still, you know, still going to have surgery, still has to go through the tightening of the skin and all that kind of stuff.
And the thing that we, you know, it's unique is how far burn care has come. And with an organization like Sons of the Flag, that we've been able to have a direct impact on burn care.
Yeah.
To where Zach is now getting, Shay's getting the care, R2's getting the care.
Yeah.
These guys are getting the life-saving and life, not life-saving, but life-changing care that's going to get them back to where they were as close as possible.
Yeah.
We're making huge strides here, and to be a part of this organization is to hear where we came from, from the Vietnam era, and to when Byrd had this crazy-ass idea 10 years ago, where we're at now.
One, it's there's a theme of getting fed up with the stagnation of what's going on, and saying, no, there's got to be something that can be done.
Yeah.
There has to be.
You know, you made a great point talking about the survivors, and this is not going to define them.
Yeah.
Obviously, Captain Byrd, it didn't define him.
No.
He speaks about it. He writes about it. He wants the world to know that it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Zach, graduating college, getting his driver,
going to go back to get his master's,
getting everything taken care of.
Yep.
Shay, world class triathlon, Ironman champion, Savage.
Yeah, yeah.
All these guys. Think about how many guys are on the team that have burn injuries, that are a part of Sons of the Flag, that are changing the fire service, that are changing the way that we view burn care in their areas.
Yep. Yeah.
These are survivors. They're not victims, and I think you nailed it perfectly. That this never defined them. This, if anything, it enhanced them.
It enhanced them. Yeah.
It made them, what we said, ambassadors now. They're ambassadors for this type of traumatic event.
Yeah.
These guys are the voice going forward to let every victim that's found in a fire or burned in an accident or something like that.
Amputee, injury, head injury.
Yes.
There's so many different things that can happen to you, but the thought process is the same. You have two choices: stay stagnant, stay in that position, or utilize that position and change what's around you, change yourself, and push forward.
It's so cool, you know, just to hear these stories. These are the kinds of stories that just get me more motivated.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you're hearing it from the source, right? I can go read and be like, oh, that's a cool story. That's a good, yeah, it's a good context. I really enjoyed it. But you're hearing it from himself.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dr. Levy, you know, what UT Southwestern is doing.
Yeah.
It has just been so cool this year.
Yeah.
To have part of Sons of the Flag kind of come in from, honestly, this story is exactly why we started.
Yes.
To where you have Dr. Levy and his team, and then you have Zach, and all, it just shows the progression of everything. Mm-hmm. The last 10 years of what we've done, we have made a difference, and it's just so cool to be a part of this group, be a part of the team, and, you know, be on this podcast with you and get our message out. You know, to firefighters, first responder, you know, every first responder, every civilian we can, we spread that message.
Absolutely.
And, you know, this is a cool week, man. It's Veterans Week. Yeah.
This Veterans Day has been pretty daggum awesome. But I was thinking about it whenever we got it scheduled. I was like, this is going to be sweet that we get to interview an individual like this on Veterans Day. And to all of our veterans out there, you know, we're always thinking of you. You're always in our thoughts and prayers. You don't just get a single day from us. It's our mission is to support you and help you and be there for you, whether it's communication, financial, education, whatever we can do. We're Byrd has an organization for that. So
he's thinking of the next thing.
Yeah.
But like we always talk about, if you want to follow us on all social media, you can find us at Sons of the Flag. We're on Facebook, the Instagram, the Twitter, YouTube. If you want to listen to any of these old shows, Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio.
Mm-hmm. SOTF Radio.
SOTF Radio. If you guys have a guest that you want us to, introduce a student we could possibly interview to get a message out.
Yeah.
That's even more important. You know, we're always looking for new people.
Email me at Landon@sonsoftheflag.org, or you can reach Bemis at
Justin@sonsoftheflag.org.
Justin@sonsoftheflag.org.
or we're on Facebook. We're on all that stuff. So if you have a story that you want to get out, or you know somebody who has a story that maybe we all need to hear, mm-hmm. reach out to us, to our task force members that are just wrecking shop still. Greg being our fearless leader, if you want to join the task force, we have the ability to do so. Send us, fill out the little questionnaire. Landon will get with you. Greg will get with you. Sherry will get with you.
Mm-hmm.
We have the best damn team, I think, that you could organize. And our team has just grown exponentially.
I've been here for 6 years, and to see the trajectory of where we're going, we just had, it's been our event season, so we had mm-hmm. our Country for Country, we had our Stars and Stripes, which was extremely successful, and to see that room, we have a luncheon, and it's a Dallas Country Club, and to see that room continuously pack out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's gotten bigger, the influence has gotten bigger, the names have gotten bigger. I mean, we had a panel of so many distinguished veterans.
Yep.
It's awe-inspiring.
Yeah.
Every single time.
Yeah. Like I said, if you want to be a part of this organization, we want you. We'll open our arms to you. We want you to be a part of this organization with us.
And it's you sharing the stories that mm-hmm. gets us to, to interviewing individuals like Captain Burke, to get us to, helping individuals like Zach and RJ, and you just sharing goes a lot further than I think people understand.
No, absolutely. And like I said, we'll put the resources in place for you. Just like any other team, the fire service, the military, you don't do this by yourself.
No.
You do everything as a team, and I think that's the most unique thing about this, is that our team is across the United States and the great island of Hawaii.
Yeah.
Even though he's probably, 6 hours
behind.
I don't know how many hours are they behind us. It's awkward when we get his email that night and he's just getting his day started.
It's
but,
2 a.m. What is he doing?
No, but we have the resources for you. We want you to join our team. We want you guys to keep listening. And again, send us, interviewees. Reach out to us, sonsoftheflag.org. All social media at Sons of the Flag. And again, thank you from the bottom of my heart. Happy Veterans Day to all of our veterans. Thank you for being the badasses that you guys are and
Absolutely.
Keeping us safe. All my first responders out there, firefighters.
Yep. Always in our thoughts and prayers, guys.
Always, man. I know we're a bunch of Neanderthals, but man, I love everybody that's in the fire service. And
Absolutely.
Police, everybody, thank you guys from the bottom of my heart. Landon, any parting words?
I just like reiterate, thank you all. Thank you, veterans. Thank our first responders. We're coming to the end of the year, and it's been another phenomenal year. I'm just super excited to see where everything goes. I've never been more excited. I think I just got married, and I've never been more excited to see what the future holds.
He's newly married.
Newly married. Yeah.
Newly married.
Newly married.
give it some time. We'll talk again.
Oh, gosh.
No. Thank you guys for listening. Until next time, make sure you guys keep the mission first.